Hi there, and welcome to The Conscious Communicator, a show dedicated to helping you find your true voice, the nonviolent voice of personal responsibility and purpose, the voice that only you can speak. The reason that most of us fail to achieve our true voice is because of the false voices that occupy the mind. The voices of ego, consumption, expectation, opinion, and self-doubt rob us of our true nature, our true voice. Join me as we have a chat about inner purpose, outer passion, and finding your true voice.
Hey y'all, welcome back to The Conscious Communicator. I appreciate you joining us again this week. My name is Rusty and I'm here to host a conversation about consciousness and communication. The Conscious Communicator is a show dedicated to helping people find their true voice, that non-violent voice of personal responsibility and purpose. The reason most of us fail to achieve that voice is because of the false voices that occupy the mind, the voice of fear, ego, consumption, expectation, opinion, and self-doubt rob us of our true nature and our true voice. You can join us anytime by calling 888-228-4494 in the United States or Canada and 877-489-6350 anywhere else in the world. You can also email us at consciouscommunicator@hotmail.com. Our topic question this week is fear. My thesis is that most all anger is derived from fear. Fear of loss, relationships, vulnerability, male-female intimacy, fear of other people's opinions, and even fear of feelings themselves. I want to take a minute to thank everybody at BBS again, especially Don, who I refer to as the Canadian Kevin Bacon or Canadian Bacon, and Leslie, the people that got me started. And now I'd like to introduce my guest tonight, which is soon to be Dr. Brian Martin. I work with Dr. Martin over at New Beginnings. We teach classes in the arena of nonviolent communication. Brian, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Rusty. I've really been looking forward to this.
What I want to do first, and we're going to do this with all the hosts on this show, is to give me an idea from your perspective of what got you interested in this topic. What's your passion? What brought you to this arena?
Well, as I recall, this was like a lot of other folks that will say they found their niche. The reality is the niche found me. I had been working at a counseling center and with some friends of mine, and we had noticed that there was a very consistent flow of folks coming in dealing with different levels of suffering in their life, their families, their communication with loved ones, friends, coworkers. And the way that they were responding to it had a lot to do with this anger that had built up inside them. And we started to develop a practice that focused on that, not exclusively, because of course we work with folks that have other issues. But that became kind of like the cornerstone of what we do. We do a lot of group work. We do a lot of individual work. We do quite a bit of family work around this issue with both adults and adolescents.
Now, in my experience, I kind of got to it from my own personal experience of dealing a lot with anger and frustration growing up. I mean, I think for me it's been a primary focus of my my life has been one of the challenges that I've had to deal with. Knowing you over the past 3 years, I don't really get the sense that you had that much experience with this issue growing up. Am I wrong?
That's very true. It's something that I started to notice a lot of when I started working with individuals and families. And there seems to be this pattern of communication in many families that has more to do with making one's point, or at least feeling like one's point has gotten across, rather than listening and understanding and developing a pattern of communication that works for both sides. Communication now for many folks has become a battle of who's going to win.
Yeah, I think one of the things, for those of you that don't know, I'm an elementary school counselor as well, and we talk to the kids all the time about the fact that in human relationship, it's not a win-lose situation. And so much of the intensity around communication comes from the fact of that need. And again, we're talking about fear tonight, and I hope you'll join us if you get a chance. But it is almost that fear of of some sort of need to prove yourself. You know,
mm-hmm.
the ego so holds on to a topic so fervently that if I can't convince you of what I'm talking about, there's a chance that my ego might shatter right in front of me. I base my whole experience on being a 49er fan or believing, you know, Republicans versus Democrats. That's who I am. And
mm-hmm.
if I can't convince you of that, then I find myself at a loss.
I think that what you're describing is when somebody, you know, has an opinion, they will identify it as their person. They will identify their belief in, like you say, a football team or a political party or something like that as the center of who they are. And to not accept their belief, their opinion, their idea is basically to not accept them as a person. And it cuts them so deeply that is their own. It's not just, you know, hey, you know, I disagree with you. You know, the Niners are not that good. Which, by the way, I happen to be a Cowboys fan. So that's probably a different show. But if somebody else doesn't like the Cowboys, and I recognize that there are a few people in the world who don't, that doesn't bother me. Because my belief in them, my desire, my enjoyment of watching the Cowboys, for example, is just that. It's my enjoyment. It's not who I am as a person. And so if somebody doesn't join me in that, it's not a rejection of me.
We get into that argument. A lot of people want to talk about the right versus the wrong, the, you know, that moral high ground, that black and white thinking that we talk about so much in the classes with the guys. Do we get close to dealing with some form of moral relativism if we just allow everybody to have an opinion? I mean, do we have the obligation at any level to say this is right and that is wrong and really stand behind that sort of a thing?
I think that might have to do with the consequence of the right and the wrong. If you believe that an act is right because of its lack of benefit, or let me back up. If you think that something is wrong because of its harm to other people, but other people don't agree with you, I think that that's far more consequential than a simple difference of opinion.
Why do you think so many people are going to the level of, and again, we're going to talk about fear tonight, and you can join us at any time calling at 888-228-4494 or 877-489-6350. Why do you think, and it's amazing to me, how quickly people are willing to become physical? And again, we talk about the difference between anger and aggression
mm-hmm.
in the classes. I mean, anger, hopefully you're angry about child abuse. Hopefully you're angry about
mm-hmm.
some of the issues. Hopefully that kind of thing. But why all of a sudden has aggression seemed to be kind of the fallback position for a lot of these people? I mean, you talked about that shattering, that sense of you're not liking me. But where does aggression come into that? Why all of a sudden then do I have to go, you know, bang, this is going to become physical?
I think there's a lot of information that we're learning from some current research that's coming out. And there was some I went to a seminar a while back that talked about, I'm basically going to synopsize 8 hours of a seminar down into the next minute or so, but they basically looked at the brains of young children, babies, that were raised in, we can narrow it down to two categories, and again, this is very oversimplified, but they were raised in either, you know, relatively calm, nurturing households where anger, violence, yelling was not predominant, and then there was another category where anger, yelling, and violence was a predominant means of communication in the family. And they looked at two regions of the brain, primarily. The cortex, and the limbic system. The limbic system, houses emotion. And the cortex is thought. And the children that were raised in aggressive households had elevated limbic system functioning. And that's not a good thing. And the ones that were raised in houses that had a more supportive level of communication, they had an elevated level of cortical involvement in their problem solving. They would take children, they would have PET scans that were taken under conditions of strain and confusion and testing environments, and they would demonstrate that when a child was confronted with a problem, be it a threat of some kind or a simple, math problem that they couldn't solve, the ones that were raised in supportive households would use their cortex. They would think their way through the problem. Whether they got to the proper resolution was actually irrelevant, but the tool in the toolbox they would use was thought. The ones that were raised in the more violent households where yelling and physical altercations were the answer, generally would use more of a limbic process, meaning it was emotional, meaning there was aggression involved. They would solve a problem by going after it as if to destroy it, not to think their way through it.
So basically what we're talking about here is the fact that aggression is going to change the mind of a child. It's actually going to change their brain. I was reading something recently that talked about the idea of couples, and a lot of the new couples recently been married 10, 12 years, who have decided to have no violence, or any kind of, not violence, but any kind of negative communication in the household. They both agreed that there would be negative communication towards one another. And there was a book written recently that talked about what's happening with these relationships, and around that 10 to 12 year range is that the relationship starts to kind of get distant. Mm. And in some ways, that even without that kind of that conflict, I guess my question is conflict at some level necessary in order to maintain a relationship? I mean, we can't just basically walk around not dealing with issues and talking about stuff that we may disagree on. I mean, there is some benefits to the debate and some ongoing things. It appears that it keeps relationships and keeps the passion alive in a relationship.
Well, as human beings, we grow. The trick is to grow together or grow apart. And when you look at those cycles, for some people, the growing apart and growing together cycle can be, over a couple of years. Some people, it's a couple of decades. So, almost any way you slice it, when you get to the 12-year mark, you're going to have a period of either traveling together or traveling apart. And it would be interesting to then follow up with those folks in another 10 to 12 years, because those who have hung on will probably go through that cycle again. That's not uncommon for relationships. However, going back to your point with the couples will not communicate in negative ways or hurtful ways or anything like that. I'm a fan of the phrase, of many phrases. The one that comes to mind is the idea that you cannot not communicate. Okay, it's a very popular phrase in our field, and if you really think about that, they're probably not communicating verbally, but they are communicating somehow. If one partner's ticked off at the other partner, there's going to be that tension in the air. There's going to be that unhappiness in the household, and that is going to get communicated.
There's going to be some distance that's created.
Exactly. Physical, verbal, sexual, emotional. Something is going to be different. The show focuses on consciousness. They will be conscious of the discontentment of their partner, and there will be communication involved in that. One partner will leave the cap off the toothpaste and piss off the other one, and there they go. I'm not an advocate of if you're not in a good place, to just keep pounding and pounding and pounding and talk and talk and talk, and everybody knows that can spiral downward. But this is where what we learned in kindergarten comes true, taking that time out, that hour, 2 hours maybe, just cool off, let the adrenaline dissipate, let your mind clear, rethink some things, maybe adjust your position a little bit, and then go back and try and have a productive conversation. And if you get, half hour into it and it's not productive, take another time out. Keep working on it. Or, sleep on it, check it in the morning.
So much of what we deal with in the domestic violence arena, I think, and again, our topic tonight is fear. If you want to join us, 888-228-4494. I'm experiencing that, you know, doing this for a couple of years and noticing a lot of the people that we work with, a lot of what their fear is based on is past experiences. Can you talk a little bit about how the brain kind of layers information and how we can, you know, kind of get ourselves into a mindset where we start to overgeneralize or globalize some of these choices that people are making?
Well, I don't want to come across as a neuropsychologist, so I'll give you that disclaimer at this point. But the basic process of what you're talking about is anticipation, anticipatory response. And if you've had this conversation with your partner, maybe it's the topic could be money, and maybe you're more thrifty and your partner spends a lot more. And so you know you've had this conversation in the past, and in the last couple times that you've spoken about it, the conversation has focused on you don't understand what's important to her, and she doesn't understand how important savings is to you, and every single time you've had that conversation, that's the way it's gone, and it hasn't been very productive, and then there's tension in the relationship for days or weeks to follow. So what happens is, let's say you guys stop talking about money. Well, then a money issue comes up that you must talk about, and you go into this just in your mind, knowing and expecting this is how it's going to go. We might as well not plan anything for the next 2 or 3 weeks because we have to have a money talk, and we cannot make it through that. So you set yourself up for that conversation to be dead on arrival. Rather, many couples, when they come in to talk to a therapist about that, will hear the therapist talk about changing around your expectation of the conversation. Even if you change it by diminishing your expectation, by saying, you know, I'm going to accept that we're going to agree to disagree, by saying that, you know, I am going to look for the wisdom in whatever my partner is saying, and I'm going to ask her for the same, that she can listen for the wisdom. And we're only going to talk about this for a short amount of time. So it's kind of clumsy and elementary, but you're changing the dynamic. I talk to people, anybody who's ever taken a dance class, you know, if you are a dancer, you know your partner's steps. You've rehearsed it a few times, if you've done a waltz or, you know, a tango or whatever it is. You know what you're doing, and you know what your partner's doing. You know what step 1, 2, 3, 4 is. If you do that, you are a better dancer. But if you expect that your partner, in a simple conversation and communication, is going to take the exact same steps they've always taken, as you take the same steps you've always taken, then you know that you believe that it is going to be a fruitless conversation. But if you change that around in the beginning and you start off with a whole different set of dance steps, then you will come out, hopefully, in a better place. Maybe not as soon, but certainly a better place.
We talk about a self-fulfilling prophecy, and I think in my experience of anger growing up, you know, I can remember being a military kid over in England, and I somehow found my way into a bar fight almost every night that I went down there. As a young 16 or 17-year-old American who wore a jock jacket and wore jeans and carried myself with a certain air, apparently I was almost anticipating the event in advance of that. And it was unbelievable to me, and I'd be, you know, I don't understand why they're picking on me. You know, why are they always jumping on me? It's their fault, this, that, and the other. But I think, when we talk to guys in the class about this constantly, we're talking about that, changing the way that you think, you know, changing, because the new dynamic is that thoughts create feelings. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to change something, you've got to change those thoughts. And I think in relationships, like you're saying, if you have a preconceived idea of the way that the communication is going to go, mm-hmm. it's going to be very difficult to change it. What advice would you give somebody that wants to change that preconception? I mean, for most of us, that takes a lot of work.
Well, I think it is a lot of work, but it's also a lot of work to go down to the bar all the time and, you know, and mix it up. You know, if you're going down to the bar, conscious or unconscious, consciously or unconsciously, you're going down to the bar, you have the look, you have the attitude, you know how to read people, because, you know, you're down at the bar every night, guess what they are too. You know who's having a bad day, you know who to pick on, you know the stories of everybody. You know the dynamic that gets set up. How to change that is probably a mix of easy and difficult. It's easy to drop that pattern of thought. You know, we'll call it a schema. That schema of thought in your mind that says, "I'm going to go, you know, go down to the bar, if you will. You know, I know that one dude, that tall lanky dude, Larry. You know, he and his wife, they're not getting along, so he's pissed off. I bet he can make a good target. You know, I can kind of pick on him and get him tuned up." Rather go down with the idea that your job is not to antagonize. Your job is not to be a victim also, because that, without getting, too much into, anyone's personal history, to go down there and to get roughed up, you also get to then go home feeling sorry for yourself. And you get some attention for having been victimized. So I think that asking yourself, what do you want out of an event, or what do you want out of a conversation, and simply stay focused on your desired outcome. Not every single step that's going to get you there, because you don't know the steps. You don't know what other people are going to be saying, how they're going to be feeling, how they're going to be reacting. But what you can control is what you want out of the evening, what you want out of a difficult conversation with somebody. If you want it to be respectful, if you want to leave, feeling good, feeling heard, feeling respected, showing respect for somebody else. Maybe you realize, gee, I don't really have a whole lot of respect for other people. Maybe I don't have a lot of respect for myself. So I really want this interaction to be one that I can feel good about. So when you start to interact, when you start to talk, when you start to have those times, check yourself. Is this how I want it to be? Is this how I want it to come out?
You notice from our experience in working in these arenas, and as we go down to San Francisco and start looking at expanding, what we're dealing with when we're dealing with people in classroom environments is lower socioeconomic situation, lower education. One of the purposes of this show is to talk about conscious communication, to try and be in touch with exactly the kinds of things that you're talking about. But that appears to me to be kind of a higher level form. When you're dealing on a day-to-day basis, you think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I mean, these are basically safety people. These are people that are dealing with food, shelter, safety issues on a regular basis. The idea of self-actualization, the idea of actually getting to the point where I'm paying attention to what's going on inside of my head, and I'm really listening, and I'm trying to detach from that. I've been telling you, I've been listening to the Eckhart Tolle CD, The New Earth, and talking about that ability to stay aware of the thoughts as they go through your head, because for most people those thoughts are incredibly random. For me, I wake up in the morning, there's a song stuck in my head, I've got things going on, and it just strikes me that so much of that is just repetitive. I can either attach to those thoughts, or I can try to be aware of the fact that they're happening and not attach to them, but that strikes me as being a very high level skill. Mm-hmm. When we're dealing in these classrooms, and again, we're in a 52-week program, so we're dealing with people at that level, What are the first steps that you got to take in order to even become conscious of some of your triggers and some of those things? Really cutting it down to the basics in terms of starting to make a little bit of change.
I think one of the biggest barriers to change is a lack of acceptance, and getting somebody to then desire change. Once they accept that there's a problem with their life, that it is somehow not as good as it could be, as they want it to be, as they had hoped for, whatever, then they have to accept that it's their responsibility to step up and make those changes and confront change. Change is a big word, in politics now, and change is one of those things that, in my mind, is not very specific. You know, I talk to people, and this is, you know, anybody who's been in my class has probably heard this same story, and I'll make it brief. I bought a house one time, and the front yard was just absolutely trashed. It was my first house, and I bought it with my brother, and we both decided that we wanted to, quote-unquote, change the front yard. We like nice lawns, planter beds, you know, lights, la 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 la. The one thing we agreed on was that we wanted it to change. And I started thinking about that time when I was landscaping and changing the front yard. And I was trying to explain to this guy, you know, when he was saying, I want my relationship to change. But he couldn't be specific as to what he wanted. And I, you know, when I had that front yard, that opportunity to change things around, I had one of, if I looked at it, you know, in a very simplistic way, I could have one of two options. I could be very specific with how I wanted the yard to be in the end. I want the driveway here, I want the lawn here, I want the planter bed here. Or take a hand grenade, throw it in the middle of the yard, blow it all up. In either way, it would change. If I wanted to decide how I wanted it to change, I was going to have to work for that. I was going to have to accept that there was going to be some labor, some blood, sweat, and tears, but I would get a better outcome. If change is all I wanted, and I didn't care how it looked afterward, I'd just blow it up. No problem. What people will do with their relationship is they'll willy-nilly change things. They'll willy-nilly, you know, that's it, I'm not talking to him ever again. Right? That's it, I'm dumping her, I'm out of here, you know, boom. They'll just randomly do things. They won't accept that the power to make it better is within them. The other barrier that we encounter is they'll expect the other person to make changes in their life, to make, you know, their own life better. In other words, if I'm not happy with the way things are in my relationship, I can talk to my partner and I can say, you know, you need to do this and you need to do that. And if you didn't do this, boy, things would be a lot better. Rather than look within me and say, all right, this is what I need to do to make a change. I need to be more this. I need to be less that. I need to let my partner know that I am comfortable being in a relationship that does X, Y, and Z. I'm not comfortable in a relationship that doesn't do A, B, and C, to be very clear about it. You had mentioned low socioeconomic status, and when we get into the folks that we work with, we realize that not everybody has a high level of education, not everybody has the vocabulary that we may have. Therefore, not everybody uses the same tools. And one thing that I have found, and I found this out early on, is that something that is very frustrating for folks, they don't have the ability to articulate what is making them mad in the relationship.
I think that's the biggest piece of it, is that people don't understand. And that external validation piece, you know, I think that's a big part of what happens to all of us. We're looking outside of ourselves for validation or for reassurance or for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also looking outside of ourselves for problem solving.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, that's where the rubber doesn't meet the road.
Mm-hmm.
We know that there's something wrong. We know we want to change what it is. But the ability to articulate that, the ability to do something about it, especially,
mm-hmm.
and again, when I entered into counseling, one of the biggest problems that I had was the counselor's desire to talk about my family of origin.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most people want to look at the family that they came from and say, you know, it was okay. Everything was relatively normal. And what we notice about a lot of communication skills is this is multi-generational dysfunction. I mean, these are people that are just repeating patterns from the past. And you're 16 years old. You swear to God, I'm never going to be like my old man. I'll never do that. All of a sudden, you're 30 years old, and you're exactly the person that you didn't want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that's the unconscious versus the conscious. I mean, Freud might have been right with the subconscious and all that sort of stuff, but I think there's an ability to access that level of thought. But again, what we have to do is, in very small incremental ways, is introduce people to the ideas that maybe they're being driven by something else. Maybe they're being driven by memories from the past.
And I think that's important because, you know, a lot of the folks we work with, we'll talk to them about their families. And, you know, they'll, like you said, they'll swear, I'm never going to be like him. Okay, well, what are you going to be like? I don't know, but I am not going to be like that. Well, okay, and these are folks that are starting to parent themselves. They, you know, have young children. And I'll talk to them about, well, how is your parenting style different than that of your parents? Well, I'm not like my parents. Okay. You know, it's like looking at, the old, you get film developed and you get back the negatives, right? What they're talking about is the negative. What's not there? Well, everybody knows a negative picture is different than the positive of a picture, right? That's why we pay for the positives, right? We hang the positive on the wall. We don't hang a negative on the wall. Well, their statement of, well, I'm not going to be like my dad. Okay, that's like looking at a negative. That's what you're not going to do. It does not reveal the whole picture. And you know, when folks come to us in our class as an individual, what we try and work with them is, what are you going to be? If you're not going to yell, how are you going to communicate? And if they're not able to develop that answer and implement that answer, then just like you said, they'll wake up one day, they're 30, and they're yelling. And they're mad at themselves because they, in their mind, have failed. They have become the person that they did not want to become. But if you think about it logically, how else were they going to know what to become?
They're just following the patterns from the past.
Yep.
You know, I noticed something the other day. It's interesting to me because when I'm with my, you know, my dog Jake, who's laying here with us right now, out walking in the orchards anywhere, and it's amazing to me that he can do anything he wants when we're out there in the orchards. It's just me and him.
Mm-hmm.
But what I've noticed is that what happens to me is when the opinion of others become part of the equation, then all of a sudden the dynamic changes. What's acceptable between Jake and I will no longer be acceptable when it's done in front of other people, because then I'm perceiving myself as a dog owner. Or, you know, a lot of times you'll see parents overreact to kids in the supermarket. They're reacting as a parent, as like an egoic, some sort of a supermodel of who they're supposed to be. And a lot of times I think we're reacting to other people's opinions. We're reacting to what other people might be thinking about us. It's more like Jake's an extension of me. And I think that's when we get into the power and control factor of domestic violence, when we get down to the real ugly piece of this. What we start thinking about, I think, is that extension piece, how this reflects on me. And, it, you know, that the outside world, I have to control those things in my life so that they reflect okay on me. Do you have any experience with that?
Well, the two points that you blend together, I think, are key points. Domestic violence is about power and control. And control for the sake of keeping me safe, right? If I am involved in a domestically violent relationship, and my partner is doing something that I don't approve of, don't understand, don't know about, then I may have an opinion of how that affects me. My finances, my stability, my future in the relationship, my access to my kids, whatever it is. And I will do things to control my partner's access to those events because of the way that they'll affect me. And that sets up a very, very damaging dynamic and a very powerful one that just over the last probably 10 or 15 years we've really started to understand and uncover through research and of course, some tragic events in the world, just how powerful that dynamic is.
Well, it goes back to the idea of fear, which is our topic for today. And again, you can join us at any time calling 888-228-4494. You can email us at consciouscommunicator@hotmail.com. But talking about fear and trying to break it down, I have a question about the nature of relationships. As an elementary school counselor, what's apparent to me, and again, I don't mean to generalize completely across the board, but what I notice, young girls in elementary school from the very beginning, like kindergarten, will start the process of developing relatively intimate relationships, usually with other girls. They're very, very quick to identify a best friend.
Mm-hmm.
They're very, they tend to be much more in touch with their emotions. The boys, on the other hand, seem to be more detached from one another. If a guy doesn't want to hang out with you that day, it doesn't appear to be as much of an issue. And as they get older, and again, I work all the way up through 7th and 8th grade, you start to see that puberty time come around, and the boys become interested in the girls, or the boys become interested in the boys, or whatever starts to happen. All of a sudden, you've got one person who's had 6 years of dealing with intimacy. They have really learned about emotion. They've learned about dealing with tough losses. They've dealt with some challenging, you know, in relationships and so forth. And then you have this other entity that's coming at it from a completely blind alley.
Mm-hmm.
Never had it in it, maybe with their, you know, a pet or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that fear when it comes to the relationship issue? I mean, do you think it's a male-based intimacy thing? Do you think there's any maybe validity to that idea?
Well, I think there's quite a bit. I think that it speaks to the way that we as a Western society socialize our kids. Again, like you said, girls, it's more allowable to show emotions of pleasure and sadness and vulnerability and happiness and the range of emotions that come with, you know, all relationships. And they are socialized to understand that it's okay. It's okay to want to hang out with certain friends, and it's okay to not want to. And it's okay to be confused about it, and it's okay to be upset about it. And, you know, and that's probably a good thing. The flip side of that is the boys. The boys are taught, you know, tough it up, don't cry like a girl, you know, you're being a baby. They're taught at a very early age to, as Archie Bunker would say, stifle it. Right? They don't say anything. They're taught to shut down. Well, then when they go into intimate relationships where they really want to get to know somebody, and of course we're making the distinction between intimacy and sexual activity, the intimate connecting relationship, when they go into those, they don't have the experience and the vocabulary and the self-confidence and the self-understanding or even the self-esteem to say, you know, I really want to hang out with this person. I really want to get to know this person. I'm really disappointed that this didn't work out. You know, I'm really upset about this. I feel this way. I feel that way. They don't have that vocabulary. And not only do they not have the vocabulary, they don't even have the consciousness that has come with to the girls. And, you know, we're a little bit overgeneralizing, but, you know, the girls at least have had the experience of it. And their vocabulary around that issue is building. The boys, you know, they're starting it, you know, in the 7th grade, they're kindergartners on that issue. They don't have it.
Well, then they're also starting to rely on the girls to manage the emotions of the relationship. So
exactly.
You start at a very early age to start to rely on somebody. Okay, you're good at this.
Right.
You know, I can remember my father coming home from work every day, and I've heard recently that it's that, you know, that one-on-one time. But at some level, it was almost like my mom's responsibility to sit there and be saturated by his entire emotional day.
Mm.
It's almost as if guys go through the day and they're not really comfortable with the idea of conflict. They're not comfortable with this, that, or the other. They have emotions, but they come home to an intimate partner and they go, here, you handle this. It's almost as if they hand it off. And I'm wondering if in that very earliest part of the dynamic where the girl has the more experience and she's the more emotionally confident one, do the boys tend to get into the habit of handing that stuff off? Here, this is your responsibility. I'm supposed to be strong.
Mm-hmm.
I'm supposed to be the one who handles this kind of stuff. But at the same time, a lot of the guys that we're dealing with, because of the violence in their household or the chaos in their household, they exist on the hyperarousal scale. They wake up every morning at about a 3 to a 5, just walking out the door. So fear is a really big part of their experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that really is a thing. They're not comfortable with being afraid.
Mm-hmm. No, they're also not comfortable with being responsible for their own emotions.
Yeah, here, you take it.
You
handle it.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to deal with it.
Right.
And then if it works out well, I'm going to take credit for it. And if it, you know, if it all goes bad, then I'm going to blame you for it. You know, and so now I've got you all twisted up in guilt. And it's interesting. They can learn that, but they can't learn the phrase, you know, I'm sad, I'm unhappy, you know, I want to get to know you. You know, they can't learn those things. But they learn the nonverbal skill of blame and putting off responsibility onto other people, or a lack of personal responsibility. They learn all that. And that's consistent with the place where we started, which is the girls deal verbally, and the boys, they pack it in. They learn to deal with things in a nonverbal, internal rather than external fashion. And so, yeah, it's going to play out in their relationships. They dump it off on other people because they don't know how to deal with it externally.
Well, you know, I was talking to a kid the other day that I work with at a catering company. It's a young girl, about 22 years old, and she was graduating from college. It was last, I guess, in June or whatever. And her boyfriend of 4 years was very upset about the fact that they were going to be, she was moving back down south and he was staying up here. And I guess there was a very tearful moment where he started talking about how much he loved her and he cared about her and this, that, and the other. And as a counselor, I'm sitting there thinking to myself, and I said to her, I said, well, that must have been, you know, pretty intense to do that. She goes, you know what? Honestly, it was a turnoff. She said it was one of the most uncomfortable things I've ever seen. I still think in a lot of ways the expectation is, and we hear this especially in education from a lot of the women in education who say we want boys to be more in touch with their emotions, we want this, we want that. I'm not exactly sure that's the case. I think we want boys to be more understanding of emotions so that they're more understanding of the feminine aspect of the world. But I don't think that we're really necessarily still at this stage encouraging boys to be incredibly outspoken about their emotional situations. I mean, is that wrong?
I think that in touch with is different than utilizing. I think, you know, I don't put words in this young girl's mouth, but if that was a turnoff, what would have been, you know, for lack of a better term, a turn on? You know, what would have been the right thing for him to do? Just shut up?
Is it the tough motorcycle guy, the guy
right.
who never shows any affection, is
right.
the one that you end up chasing
so,
after?
Right. So if that was new for him, you know, let's say the majority of their 4 year relationship, he's just, you know, toughed it up and, you know, grunted and, you know, not been very emotionally expressive, and, you know, so now all of a sudden he is. She liked that, you know, grunter for a reason. You know, she liked somebody who didn't involve his emotions in their relationship. You know, the emotional center, the emotional attention for the relationship was basically hers. And you know that gets into a different issue about, you know, why after 4 years do you expect that somebody will, you know, change or be different, you know. You know, he was and didn't work out real well, so
we're looking outside of ourselves for validation.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed in my marriage, it was in a similar situation. My father-in-law, who I still to this day think of as one of the greatest men I ever met, he was truly a stoic Texan.
Mm.
And my mother-in-law, who's another wonderful human being, was kind of the emotional center.
Mm.
But he had the uncanny ability to just kind of walk the walk and just be the strong, silent type. And when I got into a relationship with his daughter, and started out trying to do that, as most of us do in the early parts of a relationship, we play that strong, stoic,
mm-hmm.
I can handle anything. And then you get into the vulnerability aspect of it. You start asking questions. You start dealing with emotions and everything. I think it really was the kind of thing where she was like, well, this really isn't something that I signed up for. You know, I think there still is that sense for a lot of people that there are and that there necessarily needs to be two different dynamics in the relationship.
Well, there certainly needs to be room in a good relationship for both individuals' emotional life and emotional development. And if one partner is not prepared for or able to deal with their own stuff, if you will, their own emotions and their own issues in their life, then they're certainly not going to want to or be able to deal with their partners. And, you know, it makes me think of that study that you said, you know, after, you know, they're doing these relationship studies after 10 or 12 years. Well, that's about the amount of time it takes to, you know, really burn somebody out. You know, I made this commitment, and now I'm just dealing with, you know, his stuff, or her stuff, or, You know, I've got my own stuff I have to deal with, and that becomes overwhelming, and people just say, I can't do it anymore. I just can't do it anymore.
Well, you know, we're talking about this as if it's just an issue between, men and women, but the reality, and you and I both know, we're in the process of starting a nonprofit called the Anger Management Domestic Violence Education Alliance. And one of the purposes of that is to go into San Francisco and some of the Bay Area communities where a lot of the people aren't able to pay to get the kind of classes that they need. But what we also are finding out that there's a huge problem in the gay community,
mm-hmm.
With, you know, same-sex violence towards one another. So
mm-hmm.
it's not necessarily, you know, an issue of men versus women. And it's more predominant in the lesbian community. We have more of predominance of that kind of interaction in that community. Do you have any ideas about what's going on there?
Well, I think that if you look at girls in general, orientation aside, they're becoming more aggressive, more assertive, more physical in their confrontations. I mean, you look at YouTube. You know, you can Google, girl fighting, girls fighting, or whatever, and it'll take you to some YouTube sites. In preparation for the show, of course, I had to do my fair amount of research. So, it's frightening. It's frightening, and part of why it's so frightening, I think, is the way that we, again, the way that we have traditionally socialized boys and girls. Right? Girls aren't fighters. Boys traditionally have been socialized to be fighters. Well, now, you know, we're doing things, to take the fight out of them. And in many ways, that's probably healthy. But I'm wondering, are we taking it out of one and putting it in another? I'm not as familiar with gay-lesbian violent relationships, although I know a little bit about it. I can just assume that, we have girls that are becoming more and more violent, both in heterosexual and homosexual relationships. Plus, if you look at straight relationships where the female partner is the aggressor and the male is the victim, then you can assume that males don't like to be called victims. And so it is quite possible that there is a similarly high level of domestic violence in gay male relationships. It's simply that males don't like to be victims and they will not report it. Whereas females tend to be seen more as the victim in most relationships, so they will go report.
Well, it makes sense. And I know in our situation, we're dealing in the classroom. We get back to some of the stuff that we talk about in those kinds of situations. We're talking about fear today,
mm-hmm.
and we talked, again, you can join us at any time by calling 888-228-4494. We talk about the fear of feelings themselves. Do you have a sense that maybe because of that, in that we talked a little bit before about the guys, I mean, it appears to me that the only viable options for guys is either to laugh or to get angry. When I go into a middle school classroom and we start talking about a subject that makes them uncomfortable, there's two reactions. They'll either get angry or they'll start giggling and making jokes about it.
Mm.
Do you tend to think that we need to make some inroads into the idea of some sort of emotional intellect, some emotional IQ in terms of helping guys understand that there are a range of emotions out there that they have access to?
What? I think that certainly expanding upon what we call, as we call in class, the toolbox of responses. There are more responses out there than anger and laughter. Right? Those, it would seem, on a very simple scale, would be the opposites. Well, if one is black and one is white, there are many shades of gray, and I don't think that we teach the shades of gray very well. Largely because I think that we don't understand them very well. You and I, who are professionals, we do. We deal with them all the time. But it's not something that's brought up, I think, in school or in the home or in the church. So kids, male and female, boys and girls, are taught that there's a range of emotions. They don't have to get stuck on one. part of that range, you know, fear-based emotions, will often give rise to the anger, and not everybody quite understands that. And I think helping kids to understand that mechanism and the origins of some of those emotions is certainly, you know, a valuable lesson for them.
We talk so much about anger being a secondary emotion. A lot of times it's the second thing that happens in that emotional quotient and giving the kids the ability to understand. But I heard somebody say the other day that actually a feeling is the body's reaction to a thought in the head. And I thought to myself, with the exception of the basic, you know, the basic emotions that probably evolved as we evolved into a higher creature, the emotions of fear, and most of these emotions are relatively new. I mean, we're talking, the 1700s, we're starting to talk about the beginning of the novel, the self-introspective novel in France, where we started to have the idea where a lot of these emotions, prior to that you had some of it in Shakespeare, but what we talked about was this unrequited love, or we had rage, or we had guilt, we had the basics, the kind of like the seven deadly sins would get involved. But all of a sudden we've gotten into this idea that these emotions are somehow created by, that they're a part of who we are. I tend to disagree with that. I think they're more the ego's reaction to thoughts in the head. I don't think that emotions necessarily are something that we need to really, you know, spend a whole lot of time trying to figure out exactly what they are, because I think more than anything, these are basically reflections of the egoic thought process. It's more of kind of a, imagine, you know, screaming into an echo chamber. And the feeling, like, for example, I break up with my girlfriend, I see her with another guy, I start thinking she's hanging out with that guy, I create jealousy inside of myself. These emotions have been, you know, they're basically, they feel a lot the same when you break it down. I mean, you think about jealousy or frustration, or you know, they all kind of feel the same. We've kind of expanded the palate a little bit. Are we doing ourselves a favor by doing that?
I think so. Again, that's the shades of gray. And I think that we, certainly before the 1700s, developed the outer brain, if you will. I mean, it's again, not to be oversimplifying, but it's what separates you and I from Jake laying here next to us. You know, we have the ability to contemplate our own ability to contemplate, right?
I think, therefore I am.
Right. I can think about thinking, right? I can think about, you can think about your thoughts while out with Jake. Jake's like looking for the next smelly tree, you know? It's very basic, you know, and if he's smart enough to not get hit by the next F-250 coming down the road, then we're happy. So what we have is, you know, that outer cortex. That is where the real thought and the nuance of thought happens. And in so having that, you know, you have the ability to have those shades of gray that we talked about, the emotional shades of gray. Going back to what you started off with, I think that I would add to, you know, emotions are the body's interpretation of external events or the body's experience. I would add the interpretation piece, right? We have an experience. We have an experience in that we hear, you know, our partner is breaking up with us. Okay. That's the body's experience of sound. Well, I have to interpret what that means. And it means different things. For some people, the interpretation is sadness, loss, abandonment, all these more sophisticated words that, again, set us apart from Jake. No offense. As we learn to understand those, then we understand how to deal with them. As we may interpret, you know, our partner breaking up with us as relief. Oh, thank God, you know. I have a friend who says, you know, I don't date anybody around Christmas. It's too expensive. Well, I give him a lot of guff for that. But that's his interpretation. To him, relationships are about expense. You know, I think there's, you know, an intimacy and the romanticism of the holidays and blah, 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 blah. But, again, it is that interpretation piece. what does this event mean to me? Now, a lot of folks, as you know, a lot of folks that we work with, we work to basically put some space between the event happening to the body, the sound of, you know, I'm dumping you, some space between that point and their reaction to it, and help them focus on the interpretation piece. Bring consciousness, if we stay in, you know, the theme of our show today, if we bring consciousness to what it is that is happening to them. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Is it as bad as you think it is, or as you first reacted to? And go from there. Go from a position of conscious intent, rather than being, you know, the victim of your own impulsive response to an act.
Well, I agree with you 100%, and I think the most important thing for most of us, and it's one of the things that, you know, as I'm sitting here on an internet radio station talking to the people that are out there, I think the idea of that conscious intent requires some silence, you know, and in our modern day world, there's not a real sense that people have the ability to slow down, the ability to take some time, the ability to really actually, you know, and I think walking with Jake is probably the number one thing that's helped me. I got divorced 7 years ago, and the number one thing that helped me was those walks, those quiet walks in the mountains of Glen County, or Butte County in Chico, Bidwell Park, were basically my therapy. You know, that was time for me to quiet the mind and to try and find some connection. And I'm not sure that people are allowing themselves that.
No. No. You know, we live in a world that is so packed and so crowded with everything, with, you know, cell phones ringing off the hook all the time, or ringing out of your pocket or out of your purse, with, you know, 24/7 news, with tons of programming on television, with, you know, malls full of billions of people, you know, paying, you know, ridiculous amounts of money for stuff they probably don't need. Pressure on our lives to do, rather than simply be. And I think we've lost the art, and I don't profess to be, you know, perfect at this in any way, but I think collectively, we have lost the ability to simply be.
Well, that's a good place to finish up today. I can't thank you enough for joining us. And here on The Conscious Communicator, that's kind of our goal, is to encourage people to simply try and be. I talked last week about riding waves with my nephews down at Stinson Beach, and the amazing thing was to be on that wave, to actually be on the timeline, to be present and aware of who you are. And I would encourage you this week to try and find some solitude, find a little time for silence, maybe driving back and forth in your commute, whatever it happens to be, just try and shut everything down and spend a little time in your own head. It'll really benefit all of us. Again, I want to thank everybody at BBS Radio. Thanks to Brian Martin for joining me here today. And thank all you guys out there that are listening. If you like what you're hearing, please let other people know about it. And if you have any comments for us after the show, again, you can email us anytime at consciouscommunicator@hotmail.com. That's consciouscommunicator@hotmail.com. Thank you guys very much for joining us. And remember, the rest is still unwritten. Have a fantastic week. We'll see you next time. Thanks, Don.